and down every road, planting seeds just to watch them grow. My reward for this brave toil, I can hear the song of the soil.
Came here for Song of the Soil, you are in the right place. As I talk to you here, probably from the past, it's a chilly, rainy morning in College Station, and suddenly of the mind to recall this really cogent statement by Paul Harvey years ago, that mankind, for all his her artistic pretensions, cultural achievements, feats of engineering, and I'm paraphrasing here, owes his very existence to the fact that there's a thin layer of soil, and every so often, it rains. Right? It just blew my mind the first time I heard that, because it's so humbling to think that these very narrow set of conditions exist on Earth, and that is how we get by, right? So, that's about Earth. What if we were going to wind up on another planet, right? Which isn't so far-fetched anymore. If we were to try and set up a colony on the moon or set up a colony on Mars, what would it take? How would we grow our food? How would we build our roads and schools and railroads there? We would need to know something about the materials that we would use, or the soil on the moon, lunar soils, Martian soils. So today's episode is called Extraterrestrial Soils, and the song that we'll use is Fly Me to the Moon. My name is Dr. Jake Maurer, and I'm a faculty member, professor type at the Department of Soil and Crop Sciences at Texas A&M University and Texas A&M AgriLife Research and Extension, and welcome to Song of the Soil. If you've tuned in before, you know that the premise of this program is that we do a little bit of a deeper dive into a very specific soil science subject to make you more fascinated with soil science, just like I am. And we pair this idea with a song, so it's more fun, and it also helps you remember some of the ideas that we talk about in the program. So in this audio educational series today, we're going to talk about extraterrestrial soils, or those soils that are on other interplanetary bodies, right? So first off, soil is typically thought of as a uniquely Earth-bound term. It is a natural resource on Earth. It's first described and classified by Earthlings for Earthlings based on formation processes that are most assuredly unique to Earth, at least as far as we know. So soil is formed, like literally, by oxygen, silicon, aluminum, but it comes to be through the processes of wind, water flow, plant activity, and other organisms, human activities, yeah, all kinds of Earth stuff that relies on atmospheric processes and, well, life to happen. So look, here's the thing. We know that planets, other planets, and moons have some atmosphere, right? They have some evidence of water here and there, or oxygen, but none, as far as we know for sure, have humans. And we don't know so much about the possibility of bacterial microorganisms or their extraterrestrial analogs. Maybe someday soon we'll have some proof. But that just means that the application of the term soil to other planetary or extra solar system masses is a bit of a projection, to my way of thinking. And yet, it may just be the best word we have for the dirt on other planets. And to the way of thinking of many future extraterrestrial soil scientists or astropedologists, the lessons we learned and the way of thinking about soils we developed and continue to develop on Earth will be applicable and valuably applied to other celestial masses. Uh-huh. Now, a lot of people remember this book. Back in 2011, Andy Weir started serially publishing his novel, The Martian. You may have watched the movieized version of this novel on an airplane, like I did, without sound on the person in front of me's seat. If you didn't watch it on the actual space shuttle. Anyway, an important part of the novel imagines what it would be like to grow your own food on Martian soils. And needless to say, the soils part of the movie was, I think, what made it such a big hit. Not the suspense surrounding the main character's rescue, but all the smartest people have been saying that. However, the movie may have been less than well-informed about specific properties of Martian soils that are probably going to pose some challenges for our colonization of that planet. While Mr. Weir was lauded for getting so many technical descriptions correct on the side of, you know, airlocks, life support systems, etc., we actually know something about these soils now, thanks to the Mars Rover mission, and there was quite a bit left on the table there, as it were, when it came to growing potatoes in the survival pod. So, if we are to venture into extraterrestrial colonization more seriously than we have so far, then we better figure out how to grow food there, because it's real expensive to transport it. And if we want to have more than 20 people there, we need to figure out how to use locally available growing media, same as here. We call it soil. No surprise, then, that there is some serious scientific interest in studying and predicting the behavior of soils on other potential extraterrestrial colony sites for the purpose of establishing some kind of photosynthetic plant-based food, fiber, and energy production. So, according to the May 2017 CSA newsletter, which is a publication of the American Society of Agronomy, the Crop Science Society of America, and the Soil Science Society of America, space agriculture may not rely on the sun so much as the soil on other celestial bodies. To obviate the effects of space radiation on plants that our Earth atmosphere mostly regulates for us, space agriculture will probably have to occur underground or in protected conditions, requiring LED or similar light sources to grow. So that may be the first thing we need to consider. Two, we think we will need locally available growing media for long-term survival of populous colonies. And the underground gardens I'm talking about will need to be controlled environments, especially for parameters such as temperature, atmospheric gas ratios, etc. Microgravity, or something far less than Earth gravity, is projected to be a problem for plant production as well. So apparently, without gravity, capillary forces within growth media pores, which are usually balanced by gravity, think drainage here, become overexerted, distributing water throughout. This was observed in some of the earliest superorbital spaceflight experiments to block the diffusion of oxygen or aeration, preventing it from reaching root cells. And oxygen is necessary for plant root cell respiration. So to overcome this, different ways of delivering water have been evaluated, such as a membrane type of delivery or application of light suction forces at one end of the media to create flow that regularly cycles water out of pores to allow oxygen to enter. That's three. We know that some extraterrestrial soils have strong toxic components. That's four. And we know that all other celestial bodies in our solar system are devoid, or nearly devoid, of organic matter. Probably devoid. This means that they are also likely to contain no or nearly no microbial organisms that perform very necessary and plant beneficial processes. Plants do not grow well in soils without organic matter. They can, but they do better in its presence. Plants do best when they interact with beneficial bacteria, fungi, insects, worms, and other citizens of the soil. This soil ecology is critical for earth crops, and it will be critical for non-earth crops as well. So this is another problem we're going to have to solve. And that's five, and probably not the full laundry list of challenges we need to overcome through the study of astropedology. And that's why I think this is going to be a really interesting episode of Song of the Soil. We are pairing extraterrestrial soils with the song Fly Me to the Moon, written in 1954 by Bart Howard. Now, Mr. Howard wrote another 49 songs for a total of an even 50. How about that? Frank Sinatra probably was the one who performed the most played version of this song, recorded in 1964. So the song is often associated with the Apollo space missions, and no wonder. Fly Me to the Moon has been considered a jazz standard for decades. The song's been covered by so many people so many times, I can't even attempt a complete list. But I do love the Nat King Cole version, I really do. You can dive into an evaluation of over 300 artists who have done versions on your own. A lot of people don't know this, but the original title was In Other Words, right? And Sinatra delivered that in such a great way, In Other Words. But because so many people ignored this and referred to it by the first line, Fly Me to the Moon, the publisher eventually just caved in and changed the title later on. So, you know, I'm just going to say it. This song might be an obvious choice for space soils, but I like the lyric. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars, right? So Howard seemed to be imagining a blooming of life out there like we see here. And at the time, he had to know this was not the case, but the poetry of that line speaks directly to the need to sustain living colonies on other worlds. And the last thing about growing plants on other planets is directly related to this. Human health, sanity, emotional well-being are all improved by having plants around us. Crop plants are just beautiful, floral, ornamental plants. We are going to have to bring them with us everywhere we go, these plants. So Mr. Howard, Mr. Sinatra, hopefully future generations will see spring on Mars, if only in underground Martian gardens. All right, so that brings us today. Our guests are Mr. Harrison Coker. He's a PhD student and all-around great guy in the Department of Soil and Crop Sciences at Texas A&M. A lot of his research focuses on the development of our knowledge on Martian and lunar soils. And we have Mr. Mark Cusimano, who is one of the co-owners, founders, and day-to-day operations managers for a company called Martian Gardens, which creates, packages, supplies a what we call a Martian soil simulant, or a soil material that is so much like that we might find on Mars, or that which the rover studied, that if we want to research it here on Earth, this is the best thing we got, or this idea of a simulant is the best thing we can do right now, rather than bringing back tons of this stuff to Earth. So those are our guests. Here we go.
Now this man here is gonna take me by the hand, and he's gonna lead me down the right path to righteousness and all that other mother jazz. In the right tempo. Fly me to the moon. Let me swing among those stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song. Let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true.
Okay, so Harrison Coker and I jumped into a little cardboard box decorated to look like the space shuttle, and we had the conversation that follows.
Yes, sir. My name is Harrison Coker. I am a PhD student in Dr. Julie Howe's lab. I'm from outside of Temple, Texas. I grew up on a little ranch, and I came to A&M for my undergrad. I've always been super interested in outer space and, you know, how humans are going to get there. And I didn't really know how to connect with that field, but when I started working on my master's, I saw the NASA fellowship come available and I applied for it and I got it. So now we're working on trying to increase the fertility of lunar and Martian soils for crop growth so that colonists that are there in the 2030s can have something to eat and potentially utilizing plants as vehicles of, you know, metal manufacturing and other resources that might be necessary to establish a human presence.
Wait, let me just stop there. Is that a done deal? Are we going to have colonists on Mars in the 2030s?
That is the written plan right now. Is
that we better get on that.
Yeah, the moon by 2027. And by Mars by 2033. Now, they usually like to set these goals, and I think they kind of, you know, have a little 10-year kind of rollover on those. But yeah, that
wiggle,
is...
Wiggle room? I think the term is wiggle room.
That's a wiggle room. That is correct.
Okay. Have you heard of Frank Sinatra?
I have heard of Frank Sinatra.
Okay. Have you heard Frank Sinatra's version of Fly Me to the Moon?
I believe so.
Well, it's the most played one, I think. So,
yeah.
Have you heard other versions?
I don't think so. I think actually the Sinatra version is the only one I'm aware of.
It's classic. I don't have a lot of confidence in us growing vegetables on another planet in native soils with our first colonists, but they'll probably have to rely on other systems, right? Or am I wrong? Like hydroponics or aeroponics?
Yeah. So actually the fellowship that I put in was utilizing aeroponics, which have been noted for their kind of abilities or their capacity to operate well in low gravity environment, and actually recirculating that organics like root efflux and the inorganic nutrients across like a Martian soil simulant. But you're totally right. I think that the veracity of growing plants in an unamended, say, Martian or lunar soil is not going to happen. And so the Apollo missions brought back with them actual lunar soils. And a couple years ago, a team from Florida grew Arabidopsis in it. And they noted all kinds of crazy biological effects like telomere shortening and kind of an inability for these plants to maintain like a robust genetic, I guess, presence like as they would in a terrestrial soil. So there are numerous challenges. And I think that just the biggest one is the lack of organic matter.
Yeah, but before we move on, okay, I'm just going to bring us back here for a second and just tell everybody what a telomere is, because Harrison brought this up. It's a region of a repetitive DNA sequence at the end of a chromosome. Chromosomes are responsible for passing on our genetic data Telomeres protect the ends of these chromosomes from becoming damaged in different ways. And so that seems like a pretty big deal. We don't want that to happen just because we're growing a plant in a lunar soil. And then I believe Harrison was going to start talking about the importance of organic matter.
So do you agree? I mean, you're talking about organic matter, right? Which is a product of life, right? Or it is living matter,
right?
Depending on where you draw the line. So do you agree with the application of the term soil to this material, very similar material on other planets? Why or why not?
Yeah. Okay. So, that is an exceptionally well-debated idea. So when I first started working on all of this, we called it regolith because presumably it has not been biologically modified, right? It's missing that soil-forming factor. However, the space science community actually defines soil as typically being of a texture that's like less than a centimeter. So they actually will say that soil is something that's smaller than a rock. Now, a couple years ago, well, let me say this, at the Soil Science Society of America's astropodology session this year, a couple people stood up that had been going there for years and they said, don't be afraid to call it a soil, because once we have observed that soil, even with like a rover or, you know, we're bringing it back, we're interacting with it, we have modified it. And so maybe if we've never observed it, it is a regolith, but they would consider it a soil. Now, that kind of, you know, fringes the line. I think a lot of people consider soil as something that, you know, you can grow a plant in. And I think you can grow a plant in this stuff, but kind of going back to that organic matter step. And I think pretty much anything that we do is going to put some level of organic matter into the mix. So it's a hard question. I have started calling them soils after the Tri-Society meeting. But, you know, people can have... I think there's enough room between Earth and Mars for people to disagree on this and everybody still get along.
So, I mean, it's a body of science that's developing, right? And you're one of the first responders, I guess, in this body of science. So congratulations on that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's been a really remarkable geochemistry team that has worked with the rover data and satellite imagery and different spectral approaches. And they have really learned a lot about the mineral resources of the moon and Mars. But I think that there's been kind of a lack of drive to want to, you know, someone say, hey, let's throw some microbes in there. You know, like let's throw some plants in there. The literature on that is really quite limited.
Okay, let me stop you there because over the last few years when I've been thinking about this subject and reading about it, there's also, an entire body of science and social science, perhaps, on space exploration ethics.
Right. Yes, that's huge.
And I think what you're touching on, let's throw some microbes in it. If we were to go off planet and just start throwing microbes in a microbial exempt ecology, is that ethical? I didn't have this in my question, but would you think that's ethical, or should we at least stop a moment and think about that?
Right. No. And I love that you raised that point. It's fascinating because we are, you know, now aware that microbes exist everywhere on Earth. Like there's nowhere we go where we don't find microbial life. And so, you know,
is there one on me right now?
There are millions.
You are. No.
We are a microbial colony. So, you know, the question I think for me, as I love the ethics, I love reading about it. I think it's super interesting. I will let other people, you know, have their, I think, philosophical debate. But as sort of my perception as the scientist is, there's nothing that we're going to do that we will not inoculate with microbial life from Earth. And I think if we're willing to say that we want to explore these environments, we A, have to accept that we've already inoculated them with life, and that B, we will be doing that regardless. Now,
right. Even the tardigrades,
yes,
survive in outer space.
Well, like,
The surface of a space exploring vehicle. So.
Right. There was a probe from Israel several years ago that unfortunately crash landed into the surface, but they had identified that there were tardigrades on board that probe, and so, like, presumably there's just tardigrades now on the lunar surface.
Yeah, I bet they're having a good time too. So I'm just gonna ask this though: do you think we'll be allowed to take apples with us off of the space shuttle or whatever onto the moon?
I would sure hope so. Okay. I love a good fruit.
In not too much detail in case there's IP, why do you think it's important to solve this problem?
Yeah. No, I'm super happy to talk about that. And I love collaborating. I love talking to people about it, you know. So basically, like I said, the idea was that we've been growing, for my master's, we had been growing plants in aeroponics and sampling root exudates, which are these chemical compounds that the plants release through their root systems. And so anyways, I was like, you know, people are going to use hydroponics, aeroponics, something like that. But all this root efflux is actually going to be caught in that system. You know, what if we recycled it and tried to fortify like a lunar or Martian soil with that organic waste? You know, I don't think anyone has really thought about like, well, what do we do with that after we're done? And so I was trying to I'm trying to concentrate it across like a Martian soil simulate in order to bring some of that organic matter that it's lacking. So that's one thing that's one part of my dissertation. The other part deals with a really toxic salt on Mars called perchlorate. And perchlorate is a very strong oxidizer. It's made of chlorine and oxygen. And one of the positives of perchlorate is that because it is a salt and it actually pulls water out of the atmosphere, they totally believe that there is like potentially up to 3 weight percent of the Martian soil is water, and that there are subsurface, very salty brines that exist because of this perchlorate. And so the good thing is that we have perchlorate reducing bacteria on Earth. This kind of goes back to that, you know, we're going to have to introduce some microbes. And the good thing about that is that the perchlorate reduction actually produces oxygen, which is lacking in the Martian atmosphere.
So, why am I just now hearing about that?
Yeah, that's so the perchlorates were detected.
No, I mean oxygen in the atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. Oxygen is extremely trace on Mars. The atmosphere is almost completely carbon dioxide.
I thought we could just land and start breathing. Okay. Very cool. Is there anything else you want to say to the two people who will be listening to this?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that I'd always wanted to get in this field. It seemed really daunting to step forward into it. And I've had a lot of people kind of come up and say, hey, I'm interested in this thing, you know, like, how do you get involved? And I think just like pretty much everything else in academia, like, you know, find someone who's got their foot in the door that can help you find your next step. And, you know, the people in this community have been extremely happy to like share their wisdom and experience with me. And That has been really beneficial.
All right. Like I said, Harrison is a bright student and just an all-around really great guy. I can't thank him enough for talking to us today. Our next guest interviewee? Yeah. Mark Cusimano from Martian Garden.
Sure thing. Well, my name is Mark Cusimano. I'm the CTO and co-founder of the Martian Garden, and we are manufacturers and distributors of Mars regolith simulant, which is simulated Martian soil. Because while we've sent many missions to Mars, we have yet to send a sample return mission that returns any of the regolith, the loose, eroded, rocky material on the surface, back to Earth. The closest that we have are asteroid fragments from, you know, a large impactor hits Mars, sends debris out into the solar system, and some of those were lucky enough to have land on Earth, and we can study them. But that's as close as we've gotten. Several organizations have a need for simulating Martian soil, and that's where we get to Mars regolith simulant. And TMG has been happy to be a principal supplier of that for coming up on 9 years next summer, I want to say.
Okay. So we know that the rover mission has, you know, it lasted a lot longer than it was supposed to. So we got a lot of great data from Mars. And so in addition to fragments coming and having, you know, something, we're doing a lot of guesswork, a lot of good guesswork, right, on making these simulants based on the science done, performed by that probe or rover that's gone across.
Exactly.
So why did you choose the formulations that you actually have? I think you have two on your website now.
Yes, sir. Yes. There's MMS-1 and MMS-2 are our principal product lines, and MMS stands for Mojave Mars Simulant. Now, it's an interesting story. The original material was developed by Dr. Greg H. Peters at JPL for the In-Situ Systems and Planetary Simulation Lab. I believe this initial development work occurred in 2007. We chose MMS because of its immense availability. It requires very little post-processing because the original material, I'm not a geologist, so this is going to be to the best of my understanding. My understanding is that basically about 13 million years ago, there was a volcano that punched through a bed of iron ore. And the resulting magma, and of course the extruded lava, ended up being very iron rich. And actually, when you go to the site near Saddleback Mountain, you will see that it is distinctly red. Even from satellite photos, you can see that it's red. Now, MMS-1 does have some weaknesses in terms of the chemical composition of it. Now, the principal difference between Earth soil and Mars soil, particularly basaltic soils on Earth, anytime I'm referring to Earth soil on this picture, say the black sands in Hawaii, any kind of a highly eroded basalt material. So it's very, very poor in organic material, even here on Earth. But of course, on Mars, the organics are completely non-existent. But the principal difference is going to be the ratio between silicates, iron oxide, and aluminum oxide. On Earth, we have more aluminum oxide in the soil. On Mars, there's, of course, more iron oxide in the soil, resulting in the reddish color. So what we did was we decided to create a second simulant that we call MMS-2, where we add iron oxide, we add silica, as well as magnesium oxide and calcium oxide, just to bring the ratios right. So basically, what we're trying to do is to bring silica and iron up while keeping aluminum relatively low. That gets us closer to the ratios that you'd find on Mars, and that's what led us to MMS-2, which is our more chemically accurate simulant.
Okay, cool. Okay, so all these things are important when you're thinking about making a simulant.
Absolutely.
Not just the chemistry, the mineralogy, but the actual shape of the individual granules that you're talking about. So that's going to be really, really cool for people to learn. I don't know if you've ever heard of this book, The Martian by Andy Weir.
I am quite familiar with The Martian. Yes, sir.
I tried to read it, but I don't know. It seemed like a
well,
YA.
As a soil scientist, I'm sure that you saw some flaws that I did not.
All right, I'll cap myself. I'm trying to rein myself in here.
Sure.
So in that book, you know, the character who I will forever picture as Matt Damon because I saw it on every airplane seat back.
Watney is Matt Damon, absolutely.
And I never watched the movie, but I just saw him planting potatoes and stuff. But that particular scene in the or that particular segment in the book where he's really trying to build organic matter with human waste, excrement waste, right? There's a lot of validity in that, but do you see anything that was maybe missing from, I mean, Andy Weir is famous for having really researched the technical aspects. Is there anything you feel was sort of missing from the way he thought we could treat soil and get it to growing potatoes? Because I felt like he skipped a couple of things and just like plowed right ahead.
I don't think that the amount of human waste that was involved would be adequate to provide the organic nutrients that even a handful of potato plants would require, let
Right.
alone the numbers that were involved.
Okay, so we're in agreement, but you're saying
Absolutely.
that this fodder, like returning excrement, is going to be fine too. It's going to be rife with
Yeah, it's going to have the bacteria
bacteria.
you need for sure.
Some of it will be useful for plant growth. Some of it will lose its habitat, which is our gut, and just die out there. But it's
Sure.
also food for other things. Okay. Who are your customers? I mean, and generally, like scientists, teachers, hobbyists, who are you dealing with in public?
I think you broke it down pretty well right there. Now, by far, our biggest customers are educators. I'd say that we get some in the elementary range, but I'd say that it really picks up right around middle school. Very, very common thing that teachers are doing with our material is teaching the basics of the scientific method with it. So, for example, your control is going to be growing this plant in Miracle-Gro potting soil or something similar. Your
Okay.
variable is, or your test is going to be growing it in Mars Regolith Simulant.
Sure.
This allows an educator who's got, even just a passing interest in planetary science to incorporate that into their classroom. And kids tend to find it pretty interesting because what we found was that its tool is not so much to teach planetary science. What its real strength is as an engagement tool. It's about getting kids engaged in STEM topics because, especially when we're talking about space, there's very few things that you can get hands-on with. You've basically got telescope observations, model rocketry programs, and that was it. The Martian had a very rosy colored outcome of what realistically in that scenario, it's probably not going to go that well. And I think that that's just the reality of especially what the early days of colonizing our solar system is going to look like. There's unfortunately going to be a lot of risk involved, but I think that it's ultimately going to be worth it for us as a species.
All right. So, okay, that's a good statement. I'll keep that one. We've got about 5 minutes left in this recording time. Is there anything else you want to say you think is important that that I
I
haven't really
think
touched on?
that just the general push towards the development of space, as particularly our solar system, is very important for one very simple reason. Humanity needs a life insurance policy. There's a lot of things that could go wrong on one planet, but there aren't a lot of things that can affect multiple planets at the same time within our system. So if humanity, for want of a better term, can't get its act together here, then I think that it's going to be a good thing for there to be other little pockets of us out there so that we get a second chance if we screw things up.
Okay, wow. Thank you so much, Mark. Maybe now's a good time to bring it all back home.
Bringing it all back home. Bringing back the concepts that we learned. You were such good listeners. We don't hang out to dry. On your own, we're bringing it all back home.
Yeah, so. I think some of the major things that we learned today are that we're going to explore space. I mean, that's a given, whether we like it or not, whether it's ethical or not. And when we go out there, we're going to need calories. We're going to have food, and we can't carry everything with us for large colonies. So we're going to have to use the soil wherever we go, the moon, Mars, and beyond, right? So, what are the challenges? Well, the challenges are toxicities, lack of organic matter. When I talked to Mark about this, one of the things we couldn't include was his warning that soil isn't just something we're going to need to use to grow food, but also we're going to need to pay attention to the problems that come up with these granules getting stuck in airlocks and causing pressure problems, right? So There's a lot to think about there. And as far as the ethics are concerned, I mean, the consensus among our guests is pretty much that, well, we've already modified and introduced things to Mars soils and lunar soils, so we're beyond thinking first and acting later. When I asked Harrison what the biggest obstacle would be in getting Martian soils ready for colonization, he said, adding organic matter. So I followed up with him. The next question was, what do you think the biggest problem with Earth's soils is? And he said, I think the same thing. We need more organic matter to revitalize the soils that we have here on Earth. So if you don't feel like going on a really long trip right now, stick around. Help us repair the soils we have right here on our home planet.
Fly me to the moon and let me sail among the stars. I wanna know what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words,
all right, as we listen to the Out music here, which is, of course, Fly Me to the Moon, performed by Brother Ignatz Chickadee, who, thank you, Brother Ignatz, for all the musical direction you provide for Song of the Soil. We couldn't do it without you. I'd like to, while we're saying thank yous, also thank Brother Chase Bourne for laying down all the fantastic fiddle we heard throughout the program. There were some new drum stingers provided by Brother Patrick Dykes. So thank you, Patrick. I appreciate you coming over and doing that. I need to thank our guests today. So thank you, Mark Cusimano from Martian Garden, for sitting in with us and sharing your wisdom. I think it's a good time for me to point out also that Martian Garden isn't the only company in the Martian soil simulant space provision. You can also purchase a number of variants of both Martian and lunar soil simulants through what was originally University of Central Florida's The Exolith Lab, but is now available through a spin-off company called Space Resource Tech. Also, thank you to all-around great guy and fantastic student Harrison Coker for sitting in a cardboard box painted like the space shuttle with me and sharing your wisdom. So, again, there's a lot out there to think about when we think about moving to other planets. We got to get it right, otherwise we're going to have some catastrophic failures, and we probably will to begin with anyway. As always, thank you. Y'all were great listeners, and come back to Song of the Soil again and see what you can pick up. And one last thing. I think a pretty obvious question for a lot of folks would be, is Martian soil simulant safe? Well, yes. Chemically, it's very safe. It doesn't have anything in it that will, you know, harm your bare hands or anything, but there's a physical hazard associated with all soils, okay, not just Martian soil simulants. It's a very fine crystalline material, and so we do advocate and recommend that anyone playing around with Martian soil simulants or soils, creating dust, that you wear a face mask so that you don't inhale this. This is something we always do at Soil Labs. We have all our graduate students cleaning themselves for creating dust. So you do the same. Be safe out there. And, fly me to the moon. Let me sail forevermore.
all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words,